Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming back. So in this talk, the plan is to discuss the physical limit of mechanosensitivity by a single hair cell, as well as the parameters that control this mechanosensitivity and this limit. And then I will talk about friction, noise, and coupling in this order. So that we make sure that we're all on the same page, I show this picture again of a beautiful hair cell. Hearing starts with the deflection of the hair bundle that protrudes from the apical surface of each cell. A positive deflection, which is defined here and in the remainder of the talk as a deflection towards the taller row of stereocilia, increases tension in the tip link, which pulls a channel open, giving rise to an influx of cations from the outside to the inside of the cell. Now, as we've heard already maybe too many times for some, at least a few times, the hair bundle is not simply a mechanosensory antenna where you stretch, you pull on springs, open gates, and you get a current. The hair cell is actually capable of powering active movements of this organelle, which can lead to amplification of mechanical stimuli. In particular, I showed this slide already in my first talk, but there was someone this morning who had never seen an oscillation, it seems, so I show it again. So the hair bundle can oscillate spontaneously, as shown here in this video. We can record those oscillations by projecting the image of a single bundle onto photodiodes. Right. So the ability of a hair cell to power oscillations is advantageous, as already mentioned, because it provides amplification. And this can be demonstrated by applying periodic forces to the hair bundle. And this is done by attaching a flexible glass fiber onto the top of the bundle. And using a piezoelectric actuator, we shake the base of the fiber sinusoidally, typically, and record the position of the bundle. And from the deflection of the fiber, we can get the force. The key observation is shown here. This is a plot of sensitivity, mechanical sensitivity, which is defined as the number of nanometers of deflection you get per piconewton of force applied as function of frequency. And we apply the sinusoidal force of amplitude F1, which is here 5 piconewton. There's a control bundle that does not oscillate, and in this case, the sensitivity is flat and low, and is in fact defined or imposed by the elasticity of the hair bundle. It's the compliance of the bundle that sets this value, and the compliance of the bundle is about 1 nanometer per piconewton. In contrast, when the cell oscillates spontaneously, we get an increase of sensitivity, amplification, when the stimulus is applied within a limited bandwidth, centered about the frequency of oscillation. This is hertz. Okay, we work in frogs. Yeah, you know, we're not here last week, so that's why you're not asking. Okay, so we work. So and this was mentioned by Dolores already, but since you were not listening, I will repeat that. So we do work in frog. Okay, we extract a low frequency organ from the frog. This organ is sensitive to vibrations, ground bone vibrations, between 5 hertz and 150 hertz. So it's low frequency, which is advantageous for experiments, in fact. We can study them.
It's relevant for the hair cell
of the particular organ that we study in the frog.
Yeah. But I mean, it would be in kilohertz in our case?
If you extrapolate that observation to your ears, yes, it would be kilohertz, but that's never been observed so far. Okay? No oscillations have been observed at a single cell level in a mammalian system, in an extracted preparation.
I thought they would do a dish. They go up to kilohertz.
The cells go to, yeah, but not spontaneously.
Spontaneously.
Yeah, this is a spontaneous, you see?
Okay.
I go back. Where is it? Back is here. This is a spontaneous oscillation. Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. I'm here for that. So amplification is nonlinear. It's highest at the weakest stimuli. Okay, for the weakest force, you get this high sensitivity when you drive the bundle at resonance, meaning when you drive it at a frequency that's close to this frequency of oscillation. When you increase the force, the sensitivity decreases, roughly like the minus 2/3 power law that we believe is important for reasons that should be obvious now. And at high level of force, we get to a low level of sensitivity, which is the same we get when the bundle is not oscillating, when it's passive, or when we stimulate this bundle off resonance here at 180 hertz, when the oscillation happens at 9 hertz, this level corresponds to the passive behavior of the hair bundle, is defined again by the stiffness of the structure. this level here is the amplified level of sensitivity you get from the oscillatory process. So by computing the ratio, we can define a gain, and this gain is 10 for a single cell. Now, this talk is about a discussion about what limits this gain. Why is it 10? Why it's not 100 or 1,000? Okay? We know that intact organ, in particular the mammalian systems, we've seen already that the mechanical sensitivity of the organ can go up to gains that can be 1,000. All right. Now, the question I want to address, what limits the sensitivity, as I defined here, at a two-week stimuli? Now, as any mechanical object, friction will impede the vibrations of the structure and is expected to limit sensitivity. So we perform a series of experiments where we tried to measure this friction and to understand where it comes from. That's the first block in my talk. So I will clarify first the rationale between this measurement. And to do that, let's consider that we apply a symmetric triangular waveform of deflection x as a function of time to the bundle, which means that the bundle will move at a given speed back and forth at the same speed v. Okay, it goes like that. If the bundle were purely elastic, then Hooke's law would impose a linear relation between force and displacement, and the force-displacement relation would then go along a line. The energy stored in the spring on the way up, when we extend the spring, would be precisely restored on the way back, and there would be no energy dissipation. In the presence of friction, which we can model simply by a dashpot, in the force-displacement relation, we display hysteresis. And this is because we will dissipate energy. The energy in this cycle corresponds to the average energy dissipated over one cycle. This is because you add up to the elastic force and a frictional force, lambda v, where lambda is a friction coefficient. Now you see in a simple, very simple model, line of reasoning, that the height of this hysteretic cycle divided by 2 provides precisely the friction force lambda v. So by applying a periodic forcing to a hair bundle, measuring hysteretic cycles, and looking at the height of this cycle, you can characterize friction. That's basically the rationale that we used. So we took our fibers, we applied a periodic triangular movement to the base of the fiber, measured the deflection from of the bundle x, and then from the deflection of the fiber, we could compute the force, and therefore measure the force displacement cycle as we shake the bundle back and forth at a constant speed. Now, here's a result. In a simple case, we start with a simple case where we have cut the tip links. When we cut the tip links, when the bundle moves, the transduction channel will not know it because the tip links are not there to transmit the force, so they won't gate. Okay? We can cut the tip links by applying a calcium chelator, and this is because the tip link is composed, as we've heard before, of the association of two cadherine, unconventional cadherine molecules, protocadherin 15 and protocadherin 23, and they stick to one another in a calcium-dependent manner. So if you add a calcium chelator, you get rid of the calcium, and you kind of disrupt the tip link. In this case, as you can appreciate here, it's a real experiment, the force displacement cycle looks just like the simple drawing I just showed you a slide ago. Okay? The bundle here moves at a speed of 20 micrometers per second. In particular, the friction force, which corresponds to the height, does not depend on position. As you increase the speed of the stimulus from 23 micrometers per second to 80 micrometers per second, you see that the hysteretic cycle broadens, which is expected because the faster you go, the more the system will dissipate. So you get more energy dissipated, which corresponds to this area. And if you plot the friction force, which is the height, divided by 2, as a function of velocity, you get linear relations, and you here have measurements for 10 cells. From such measurements, we can compute a slope. It's a straight line, so we can compute a slope, and this slope is about 100 nanonewtons second per meter. Now, the value we get from this measurement is, and we're very happy to see that when it happened, is very remarkably similar to an estimate, a numerical estimate of, doesn't work? Okay, so the value we get is remarkably similar to a numerical estimate of the adynamic drag coefficient that acts on a hair bundle, which can be computed from finite element simulations of the detailed interaction between the fluid and the stereovillous structure of the bundle. This was done in Jim's group. These simulations were done by Jonas Baumgart. So in return, then, we interpret our measurement as a measurement of viscous drag. When the tippings are disconnected, are cut, what we measure when we go back and forth is simply viscous drag on the hair bundle. The value we get is, I told you already, is 100 newton second per meter. And as a rule of thumb, that means that if you shake a bundle at 10 micrometers per second, it will experience a friction force coming from viscous drag of 1 piconewton. 10 micrometers per second corresponds to 1 piconewton friction force. Okay, now we set the stage for the real experiment, which happens when the hair bundle, of course, is intact and the tip links are there. In this case, we still observe an isotropic cycle, that's fortunate, it's dissipation, but it's more complex. In particular, when we start from a negative deflection here, where the channels are expected to be all closed and we move towards a positive direction, there's a limited region of displacement where the slope of the relation gets lower and then gets big again. On the way back, we see the similar phenomenon. And this rings a bell, at least if you were here last week. So it doesn't ring a bell. So that's why.
No bells.
Yes, no bells in your head. Okay. You'll be my, you know, in every show there's always a guy. So this rings a bell because mechanosensitivity of the hair bundle comes from the connection of mechanosensitive ions, ion channels, to elastic springs. And it's a non-phenomenon that, in that case, you expect softening of the hair bundle when the channels open or when they close. It's a phenomenon called gating compliance that is summarized here. Okay, if you pull on a spring attached to the gate of a channel, that will tend to open the channel. But when the channel pops open, it will reduce the extension in the spring by an amount d. Okay. So because this extension will be reduced, the tension in the spring, the elastic restoring force, will also be reduced by an amount z called the gating force, which is the product of the stiffness k of the spring times this d. So as you pull, imagine now you pull with a rubber band on the door. If the door is closed, you will feel the linear elasticity of the rubber band. But if the door pops open, you will feel that rubber band is softer while the door is opening. It's because the extension of your rubber band will have decreased, because you get a kick in the same direction as the force you're applying, which is the gating force.
So I know I wasn't hearing this.
Yeah.
Is this just a cartoon or is this for real?
This is a cartoon, it's a model.
Yeah, but okay. I mean...
But this is measured, and it's been calculated.
It's not really happening like that. I mean, actually, they're... How close is this mechanically?
You can ask the man. He's hiding.
I mean, could be a million different ways.
No, this is a concept. It doesn't tell you.
What's
the molecular nature of the spring or where precisely is the spring. It tells you that the ion channels that are opening and closing when you deflect the structure, right. I pulled open by some kind of elastic element. Okay. If you have that, then you expect the mechanics to be nonlinear. And as a matter of fact, we do see these nonlinearities, which in return provides support.
Conceptually
provides support for this thing.
Okay.
The force displacement relation of such an elastic spring will be nonlinear. And we've seen that many times already, but for an isotropic bundle, it can even look like that. Okay, we need to turn on the. So the force you apply to such a spring as functional displacement is nonlinear, and its relation with the gating of the ion channels. So this is the open probability, this is displacement. If there were no gating, we will get a linear relation. Because of gating, we get a reduction in the force we must apply, and this reduction is in average equal to the number of channels we pop open. So it's a single channel here, so it's P open times the single force they produce. Okay, I'm going fast here because we've discussed that already a couple times. But the message is that when we go back to these cycles, when we see softening of the bundle in these relations, we can tell with a good amount of confidence that this is when channels are gating. So if we start again from this deflection, which is very negative, where the tip links are slack, there's not much tension in the tip links, and we move positive, we expect the slope of this relation to go down when channels gate, which happens actually. And once they're all open, the spring should be stiff again, because we're now pulling again on this rubber band. The door is fully open. We are feeling the linear elasticity of the structure again. When we go back, channels are all open here. we go down, we reduce the extension in the spring, we reduce it until the channels abruptly close here. We get the softening, and now the channels are all closed, and we get the linear elasticity again.
So if you were to do this faster,
I will go. I will describe that. So here it's for a given velocity, 25 micrometer per second. Now going back to friction, you see that friction is roughly the height. Okay, you see that the height of this, the width of the height of this cycle is greater in the limited region of displacement where channel gate. On the sides here, where channels are either all open here or all closed there, it's thinner. I told you just before that for viscous drag, we expect, because the bundle is moving at 25 micrometers per second, a friction force of 2.5 piconewton. 10 micrometers per second corresponds to 1 piconewton. Here, you see that this width is 40 piconewton. You divide by 2, you get 20. That means that in the center, the friction force is nearly one order of magnitude larger than the one you expect from viscous drag. So this suggests an interesting thing, which is that the transduction channel are actually contributing to Habermas friction. Now, to test that hypothesis, we have a magic bullet in the name of a channel blocker. We can use a channel blocker. If we block the channel, we will prevent channel gating, and then we expect that this contribution to friction should disappear. So we can test that in an experiment. And I'll show you an animation. This is a real experiment. It's not a simulation. It's a real experiment where we do just that. So we measure this hysteresis, and when the red comes in, we apply the drug. And as you can see, we get rid of the gating compliance, as expected if the channels do not gate, but we also get rid of the bubble in the center, so we get rid of friction. So this experiment demonstrates, and this is the proposition of the two, demonstrate that the channel gating is actually contributing friction. This is a plot of the friction force as a function of position. On the control conditions where the channels can gate, so there's this increased friction in the center, when we block the channels, this disappears. The difference between the two defines what we call channel friction. Now, to better understand where it comes from, let's go back to this hysteretic cycle and spot precisely where the stiffness is negative, which is roughly where the channels are half open. You have a question, Daniel?
No.
Okay, so on the way in, the channels will open here when we deflect the bundle positively. On the way back, they will close there. And you notice that they don't gate at the same position. There's a shift. The channels will open at a position that's more positive relative to the position at which they will close. We call that shift the gating shift. Now, when you change velocity, coming to your comment, from 15 micrometers per second to 90 micrometers per second, we see first that the hysteretic cycle gets broader, as expected. You get more dissipation. It requires more work to move the bundle faster. But also, we see there's a shift of the position where channels open towards larger deflections, and a shift of the positions at which they close to more negative deflection. So the gating shift is increasing as a function of velocity. The relation between this shift and velocity, I mean, we don't know, you know, it's noisy, but we can always draw a red line inside there. And the slope of this red line defines the time. Because this is position, this is velocity, the slope defines the time. The time we find, we divide by two because we go over a cycle, is a few hundred microseconds. What's the meaning of this time? Well, we believe that the meaning of this time is that it corresponds to gating of the channel, the time it takes to open a channel. Channel gating is not instantaneous because when you have a protein, you need to change its conformation, you have to break bonds, it takes time. Okay, so the rationale is then, when you move the bundle will open, but it will take a certain time tau to open. Okay, it will not open instantaneously. So by the time it's open, you will have moved the bundle a certain distance. As you increase velocity, you will move a larger distance before you open the channel, thus creating this shift. That's the idea that we want to test. So within the framework of the gating spring model, again, this picture that you like, we have now two physical parameters. The first one is the gating force, Z, that I've already introduced. The second one is a time scale, tau, which is the activation time of the channel. We can build a simple model where we apply a periodic movement to the hair bundle, a triangular movement, as we do in experiments. This is x of t. Now, the Getting Swing model tells us that the force displacement relation of the bundle obeys this nonlinear relation. The bundle moves, so there should be a frictional force in addition to that force that we have here. There should be a term lambda x dot, where lambda is the viscous drag applied to the bundle. But for the sake of the argument, we will ignore that viscous drag so that the model doesn't contain any explicit source of dissipation. Okay, we just have springs and external force. I think this term here corresponds to getting compliance. Okay. Now, when the channels are at thermal equilibrium, the open probability of the channels, P over here, is given by Boltzmann distribution of states. This is a sigmoid that I drew here. Okay, it's a single sigmoid. If you have two states, a single sigmoid. However, because the bundle moves, the channels are never at thermal equilibrium. They can only relax towards thermal equilibrium, which is P infinity here, with a certain time tau. And if you have in mind a model of a channel where it has only two states, closed and open, this time tau will be given by the inverse sum of the transition rates over an energy barrier going from the closed to the open state or going from the open to the closed state. Now, this model is very simple, so you can solve it analytically. You can integrate this equation, get how the open probability will vary with time when you move x according to this shape, and then we inject this function into the force displacement relation to get the hysteretic cycle. Yeah?
Is this the traditional way that they model, like so in a Hodgkin-Huxley model, where they actually model opening and closing channels to generate an action potential? They have these time ODEs in terms of some other parameter, right? Like it's not in terms of the probability of opening. Is that correct? Or is this analogous to Hodgkin-Huxley?
I don't remember quite, Jim.
The other parameters you mentioned are voltage dependent.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have the rate constant dependent on switching of so-called particles, right? The M, H, and N between two states, and those are time-dependent differential equations. So here one has the opening simply directly proportional, or the rate of opening directly proportional to the force.
Yeah, this equation is very simple. It's saying that at steady state, you know, PO equals P infinite, and if you're away from steady state to leading order, you will relax exponentially towards that.
No, I certainly understand it. I was just wondering whether it's of the same
type. No, well, it's more, Hodgkin is more complex. It integrates other degrees of freedom that we don't have.
I see.
Yes, it's just simple to state. So here's how it works. We first look at the open probability versus position, the sigmoid. Okay, if we move back and forth the bundle very slowly, the channels have time to equilibrate. So in this case, you're on the red curve. What you measure is simply the equilibrium relation between open probability and position. However, as you shake the bundle faster, it will take same time for channels to open, but they're not at equilibrium. So you would like to start opening here, but as you open, you continue moving. So in fact, you will be open with an open probability of 0.5 when you have moved by a distance, which is roughly for low velocity, the velocity times the time of the channel opening, gating. Okay, as you go back, the same thing happens. Thermodynamics imposes that you want to close here, but it takes time to close so that you again open this hysteretic cycle.
Do you model the opening and closing times as the same tau?
In a simple, for the physics, you don't need we just take a number here. Whereas in reality, it's not the case.
As V gets larger and larger, you can estimate how many channels? No.
Well, the channels here, they're all open here, they're all closed, but it will broaden. As you increase the velocity, you will broaden the hysteretic cycle.
In the limit.
What?
In the limit, as you make it real fast.
There will be a saturation at some point.
Just saturation.
Yeah, you will see that. So because the beauty of this of the hair bundle is that there's a direct connection between the state of the channel and the force.
Right.
All right? There's a reciprocal relation between the state of the channel and the force displacement relation. So if you open a hysteretic cycle in this curve, you automatically will get one here. So if you go slow, you just measure this negative stiffness force displacement relation that we've seen last week a couple times. But if you go faster, you add up some force, that will correspond to this electric cycle. So what I showed here is, although there's no explicit source of dissipation in the model, there's no friction added, you create dissipation. And you create dissipation, why? Because you have these delayed internal forces corresponding to gating. Okay? Now, if you increase the velocity, you can plot the friction force as a function of position. When the velocity increases from 1 micrometer per second to 100, you get this peak that grows in amplitude. And if you plot the friction force at zero, at the peak, as a function of velocity, you get this nonlinear growth that saturates at a value, it's plotted here, that saturates at a value which is given by half the maximal gating force you have. Half is because you go back and forth. I mean, this friction force comes from the opening and closing of the channel, so you cannot go farther than having all the channels kicking, right? So there's an interesting saturation in the model. At low velocities, there's a regime of linear friction. Okay, the force grows linearly with velocity. The slope of that relation defines the friction coefficient. And it's interesting to discuss on what parameters it depends to. We have only a few parameters here. It's created by gating, so it's no surprise that it depends on the gating force Z. It goes like the square of the gating force. The more channels you have, the more in effect. It's proportional to the time tau, the activation time. The effect comes from the fact that gating is slow. It's not instantaneous. The slower the channel, the bigger the effect will be. Okay?
Is this just in the front? The gating is much, much faster.
So, well, I'm discussing this in the frog, and then we can try to... Yeah, no. So you're asking in the mammal, like the channels will be faster. It's much faster. They're much, much faster. So this term will be smaller, but the bond. Well, we can discuss that. There are more. N is larger. There are more stereocilia. The bundles are shorter, so the Z will be effectively greater. And this effect together, so one effect will make the friction smaller, the other would make the friction larger, so the end result is unsure. Nobody knows, no.
And what is the implication of that for?
Okay, you want to finish me to finish my talk before I finish my talk.
No,
by the end of the talk, I hope we discuss the implication, okay? So the surprise is then, is you plug in numbers into those parameters because we can measure all those numbers. Okay, we know Z, we know N, we know tau. We find that this friction coefficient is about 1 micronewton second per meter, which is tenfold larger than the viscous drag on the micron-sized bundle, which is binding because it means that gating of only 50 channels can produce internal friction forces that completely overwhelm the viscous drag on this structure, which is much bigger than them. Okay, that's what we find. So, gating and transcription channels provides a major contribution to Hubble of friction, at least in the frog, up to 10 times the viscous drag, atomic viscous drag. Channel friction arises from large gating forces, Z is large in these animals, and finite activation kinetics. The channels are not infinitely fast. It takes time to open a channel. Now, to finish this part of the talk, I'd like to make a final comment. Gating forces have a dual role. When channel gate, they go from closed to open state, this is the open property as a function of position, it was well known that the apparent stiffness of the bundle decreases. It decreases by an amount delta k that's given by nz squared over 4kt. So it's proportional to this nz squared term. What I showed you is that in addition to this decrease in stiffness, we get an increase in friction. This increase in friction depends, of course, on velocity. The larger the velocity, the more friction you get. But the interesting thing is that the friction coefficient lambda c, owing to the channel gating, is in fact proportional to this negative stiffness, the decrease in stiffness, delta k, that we get, and the constant of proportionality is simply tau. So the increased friction and the gating compliance are actually two sides of the same coin. Any mechanosensitive ion channel should show this phenomenon. They are built in, the mechanosensitivity. If you attach a spring to a channel, and you open the channel this way, you expect to have a nonlinear spring with decreased stiffness when channel gate and an increased friction. Okay, these are fundamental properties that ought to be observed in any mechanosensitive device.
Experimentally, did you test whether this spring friction coefficient depends on temperature?
No, we have not varied the temperature. There's a one over T term.
No, I mean, it will affect the shell alteration.
Also the articulation energy, yeah, it should depend,
faster,
yeah.
So it should change the friction.
Yeah, in principle, right, there's a Q10 of 2, we could anticipate the variation of that, yeah. Okay.
So what is the temperature?
So it's a frog temperature, so it's a room temperature. Therefore, frogs are cold-blooded animals, so it's frog temperature.
So does this rule out TMC1, TMC2 complex for the frog? I mean, is the 0.5 millisecond delay compatible with that channel, or do we know?
I have no idea. There's no theorem that tells you that TMC1 should be fast or slow.
Okay.
I think there are fundamental questions attached to that. You know, what defines the time scale of activation of an ion channel? It's not so clear to me. I mean, in this case, the channel doesn't work in isolation. It's connected to the cytoskeleton by some springs, and so the environment will be important, I suspect, as much as the chemical nature, the molecular nature of the channel itself. So the answering this question is quite tough. So after friction, I'd like to discuss noise. If you look at a spontaneous oscillation and compute a power spectrum, you get a peak. So in that sense, you get a true oscillation. We have a peak. You can define a frequency. Okay. Here, in experiments, it ranges from 5 to 50 hertz. However, the peak has a certain width. So the frequency is not perfectly defined. There's certain precision for this frequency. You can compute a quality factor by having the ratio of the Kassi frequency, the frequency at the peak, divided by the height at half the maximal power. And you get a value typically of 2. Okay, that means that, in fact, the oscillation will lose the information where it was before, after 2 cycles of oscillation. The phase coherence of the oscillations are actually quite low. These oscillations are quite noisy, in other words. Okay. Now, where is the noise coming from? There are many sources of noise, but there are at least 2 that we can discuss with what I told you earlier. First, the bundle is immersed in a viscous fluid. Particles of fluid shake around by movement, so they will bombard the bundle and shake the bundle from outside. Okay, this comes from the thermal fluctuations of the particle of fluid that are shaking the bundle. This is a passive source of noise, and fluctuation dissipation theorem tells you that you can relate the intensity of the force provided by these thermal movements of the fluid particle to the friction coefficient that we measured in the previous experiment, lambda H, the atomic friction coefficient. On average, this force is 0, but its variance will be proportional to the friction coefficient lambda H. So having measured lambda H is important because it tells you what is the magnitude of this force that the air bundle should experience. Okay, if you know the friction, you know the magnitude of the noisy force that applies to the bundle. Now there's another source of friction that's more interesting, of dissipation, of noise that's more interesting, and because it comes from inside. Is due to the fact that the channels are flickering. Okay, they open and close. If you have a channel that has an open probability of 0.5, that means it will spend half of its time open, half of its time closed. It will flicker between open and closed states. And because the channel is connected to a spring, as it flickers, it creates an internal force that fluctuates. The magnitude, on average, is zero, but its variance will be related to the friction coefficient owing to channel friction that I just measured. Okay? So the measurement of friction that we performed gives you scales for the noise forces that this structure should be subjected to. So what's the consequence of having these noise terms? And of course, yeah, we measured the channel clatter. You know, this term here is tenfold larger than this term there. So in fact, the major source of noise comes from channel clatter, not from the thermal movements of the particles of fluid. Now, I showed you last week that we have a quite detailed understanding of how oscillations emerge in this system, and we can describe it as an active dynamical system with 2 degrees of freedom, one is the position of the bundle, the other one is the position of an adaptation motor. I will not go into details, so we can discuss that after. We can discuss that after if you want. So there is a model that we can use to describe those oscillations. And we can we have two control parameters. So most of the parameters, as I said last week, are fixed, because we can measure all displacement relation, which will give us, you know, these parameters KGS, KSPD. We know the friction, lambda. And in fact, this friction has now two contributions, one that comes from viscous drag, the other one that comes from channel opening and closing, gating. So we know this value, lambda. And then we have a second equation that describes adaptation, and adaptation also being characterized in experiments, so we know values. We have values for lambda A. There are two control parameters in the model that we don't know. One is the strength of the calcium feedback we have on the motors, and the other one is the number of motors, basically, how much force these motors can apply. I showed you last week that with a simple model like that, you can compute a state diagram as a function of these two control parameters, the calcium feedback strength and the maximal motor force, and that in this state diagram, there's a region where the bundle oscillates, which happens when you have intermediate values for this F max parameter and this S parameter. And there's also a very interesting line, this is the thin line here, that delimits a region of transition between oscillations and quiescence. This line, by definition, is a line of hot perfection. And I hope by now that you measure that this has implications, because if you're close to a hot perfection, you expect some generic properties that Frank has beautifully described in the previous talk. Okay, so we have hot bifurcations in this system. If the bundle were able to operate near this line, we would expect that it would have infinite sensitivity. That's what Frank told us. Okay, however, there's noise. This is a deterministic analysis of the model. There is noise. We should add noise to the thing. And this can be done. We can add noise term. We now know how to compute the strength of this noise term. On average, it's zero, but its variance is proportional to the friction coefficient, which is the sum of the Avalanche contribution and the channel clatter contribution. And there is another noise term here on the motor equation. I will not detail how it's calculated. We can do that. Okay, it's model dependent. Here we assume that adaptation is mediated by motors, so there's some stochasticity in there because the motors, they bind, they unbind. So we can compute noise in that process, and this actually gives us an estimate here where there's an effective temperature associated to the stochasticity of motor binding and unbinding that is about 1.5 the normal temperature. So it's like we, as if we had almost thermal noise in the second equation. Now, if we had noise, we can then compute the sensitivity of the system to sinusoidal forces. Okay, this is a plot here of sensitivity as a function of the applied force. And we do it under two circumstances. Either we use very large forces, and then we probe passive mechanics. These are the purple points. And in this case, we again find something that's about one, because we basically measure stiffness when we do that. Okay? Or we can apply weak forces. And then we do so along lines of equal open probability. So we explore the whole state diagram by moving along a line of a given open probability. And you have the code here. And you see that you get maximal sensitivity when you actually move on the line, these are the disks, where the open probability is 0.5. So if you move on this line here, when you're outside of the oscillation region, there's no gain, there's no sensitivity. Yeah, there's no gain. The bundle is weakly sensitive. As you enter the oscillatory region, the sensitivity increases sharply, but then it saturates and then falls as you move out of the oscillatory region. If you do the same at other open probability, you will measure less amplification from the oscillation. What do we learn here?
So do you stimulate exactly at resonance?
We stimulate at resonance, yeah. Okay, we stimulate at resonance. What do we learn here? Well, we learn first that, you know, there's no point in the state diagram where the sensitivity diverges. Okay? And as Frank already told us, in the presence of noise, there's not such thing as a hot perfection. Okay? It vanishes out. And the reason is quite simple, is because if you have close to a hot perfection, the oscillations are of a very small amplitude. So if you have noise, you just simply destroy the phase coherence of the oscillator and you lose it. Okay? Second, with the noise intensity that we plug in our model, and for which I hope I convince you we have good, you know, they're constrained by experiments, we see that the maximal sensitivity we can expect from a single bundle is about 10, not more. So in return, that means that the bundles are actually operating close to an optimum in that respect. The oscillation provides amplification at the max. Its amplification has a gain of about 10. And this, we learn also that this maximum is set by the noise and the friction that we have in the system. Now, the optimum of mechanical sensitivity is limited by noise in this view. Now, this idea, just a naive slide, but it helps me, so I show it to you, it helps me. So this concept applies also to any critical oscillator. If you take the Hopf normal form, so you take any dynamical system that operates close to a Hopf bifurcation, it's deterministic, it will obey the normal form, okay? If you operate right at criticality, the control parameter omega will precisely match the critical value omega c. And if you stimulate at the characteristic frequency omega naught, then the sensitivity decreases like the minus two-third power law of the force. That's the critical behavior that Frank described in the previous talk. Okay? So there's the lower the force, the higher the sensitivity. There's no limit to that. It's an essential linearity. Now, if you add noise to this normal form, so the system is critical in the absence of noise, you add noise, what happens is that you will kill the high sensitivity that you have at low forces. And the more noise you add, the noise level is D here, the lower sensitivity you reach to large forces. So it's a general phenomenon. Okay, it doesn't depend on the detail of the oscillator that you have in hand, although I showed you how we think it works for the single bundle. It's a general phenomenon. Now, so thus, because a single hair cell is subjected to significant amount of noise, the sensitivity can achieve is limited. However, in reality, in intact organs, hair cells do not operate in isolation. They are coupled together by overlaying structure like membranes, and this is a beautiful picture from Beshara Kashar that shows you how hair cells are coupled with an overlying otolytic membrane in the sacculus of the bullfrog, which is the organ that we study. So if that's the case, if this cell oscillates, the neighbor should know it because there's coupling. So the question then becomes, and that's for the 10 last minutes, I don't know how am I doing here. Oh, is it okay?
Perfect.
I didn't look, so I don't know. Maybe I'm...
Gigantic.
Yeah.
Concrete?
Yeah. But we can discuss that later. So the question is, what is coupling doing? And so you already have the answer because Frank told you on a very broad and general level what it should do. But I would like to describe briefly how we did it in experiments. So in experiments, we couple one cell to two neighbors via springs. And the only way the central cell, the green cell, can know that it has neighbors is through the springs. So it has no eyes, cannot look around. It can only feel, you know, the forces that are coming from the springs. That's how the coupling works. Okay. So having realized that, the way we perform the experiment is by coupling a real dying busy cell, busy dying in a frog here, to a computer simulation that will apply to the bundle the force that it would see if it were coupled to neighbors. So we apply a procedure of virtual reality where you have a real bundle coupled to two neighbors that we will call cyberclones by springs. So what is a cyberclone? A cyberclone is a stochastic stimulation that mimics quantitatively the spontaneous behavior of the bundle, frequency, magnitude of oscillation, quality factor, as well as its responsiveness to sinusoidal stimuli, sensitivity, and gain. We can do that just with using this model. So we can mimic really the oscillation properties of a given hair bundle. This is a real bundle. This is a simulation. This is the histogram of position. This is the power spectrum. And we can also mimic the responsiveness of this hair bundle, you know, how much gain you get. So we find parameters for a given cell that mimic as close as we can the behavior of a cell. And then we perform the following. So we have a fiber, and we control the position of the base of the fiber. We measure the position of the bundle at a time t, which is ndt, where dt is a sampling time. And we know the position of the cyber clones from the previous step. Okay? Knowing the position of the bundle and knowing the position of the fiber clones, we can compute the force that the orange bundle applies to the blue bundle, because this force is F1. F1 is simply the stiffness of the spring that we have times x minus x1. And we can also compute F2, which similarly is given by k equals x2 minus x. Knowing this force, we can do two things. First, we integrate the model to compute what will be the position of the cyberclones in the next time step. Okay? And second, we actuate the position of the fiber to apply the force to it, to the bundle that we just calculated. Note that this is a procedure where, of course, the bundle position will depend on the simulation, but the simulation will also depend on the bundle position, because the cyberclones will fill by reciprocity minus F1 and minus F2, respectively, which depends on the position of the real bundle. So now I can go fast. If there's no coupling, the three oscillators, the real one and the two simulated one, they live their life, they oscillate, but there's no phase relation. If you couple here by a spring of stiffness 0.4 piconewton per nanometer, what happens is that they synchronize, which is expected. The result of this synchronization is that the power spectrum of the real bundle, we're just looking at the real bundle now, the one that is alive and dying. If you look at the power spectrum, in the uncoupled case, we get this broad spectrum. When we couple, there's a shift to the left because the cyberclones were not that good. They were a bit slow. Okay, we slow down the oscillation. But the remarkable feature is that the power spectrum gets thinner. And you can see that better if you superimpose or normalize this power spectrum. You get a thinner power spectrum, which means that oscillations become more regular. Okay? Entrainment of noisy oscillators results in synchronization, which in turn results in more regular oscillations, as if you were averaging noise, less noise. If you have less noise, you expect to have greater sensitivity. This is a sensitivity as a function of force that you get with no coupling. If you couple the cells together, you get this increase of sensitivity at low levels. This increase depends on the strength of coupling. This is the strength of coupling here, the sensitivity. You get an increase by some amount that saturates here. So we get about twofold, I think, increase, roughly. The gain is increased. So coupling cells together is good. So you can team up lousy amplifiers together, they all become better amplifiers. That's the morale for the day. Okay, so this has been shown by Frank. So this is a simulation. Of course, if you couple more and more bundles together, you expect the sensitivity to grow higher and higher. And before I finish, I'd like to show you this plot for the bat woman. I like this plot. I'm not sure it's entirely related to what I just said, but I'm just puzzled by that. In a mustache bat, there's an acoustic fovea, which means that there's a region, a significant portion of the cochlea that's devoted to the detection of one frequency, which is about 60 kilohertz. So the bat is devoting about 2,000 cells for detection of just one frequency, because it's critical for its survival, okay? It does echolocation. Remarkably, if you look at tuning of the nerve fibers in this species, they're extremely sharp, beyond 1,000. And I can't help but think that this is a result of coupling of many cells that do the same thing together. If you do that, you average noise, and you get a better oscillator that will show very, very sharp sensitivity and high selectivity. Yeah, 7 millimeters. So I'm done. So these were the conclusions of the first talk I gave. It's good to have oscillators because they provide only amplification. They extend the dynamical range, they increase efficient selectivity. There's a price to pay for that because the amplification is nonlinear, so you get distortions. An oscillator is not a high-fidelity amplifier. What I showed you today is that if you have a single cell, amplification by oscillation is limited by noise and friction. So there's not much, you cannot you cannot explain the very high sensitivities that are observed in intact organs from the operation of a single cell. However, if you couple a group of cells together, you can synchronize them, average noise, and enhance amplification. So the conclusion of that is the view we then have is that the cochlea then, if you expand, we try to be provocative here, if we expand what we've learned from a single cell from the frog to an entire hearing organ, then the image that emerges is that the functional unit is not a single cell, but a group of cells, perhaps 100 cells, that together work as a sensitive and frequency-selective oscillator. And then you need to explain how you tune the frequency of oscillations along the cochlear axis from the high frequency at the base to the low frequencies at the apex. I'm done. I'd like to thank Volker. We did the experiments on friction. Jeremy, we did the experiments on coupling, together with Kai Dierkes, Benjamin Lindner, Frank, and Bjorn, who did the original work in 2004 on the effect of noise on amplification. And thank you for your attention.
In the plot where you're showing the sensitivity as you traversed lines on open probability in the state diagram, I was just wondering how you define sensitivity.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's the usual way. So we apply a force that has only one frequency component. And what we call, so the response will have many frequency components. And what we define as the response is the Fourier component at the frequency of stimulation. Then sensitivity is defined as, is frequency dependent, and is defined as the ratio of the Fourier component of the force, and take the modulus of that.
So this doesn't account for the fact that the bundle has a non-zero component.
You're right. So if you look at the power spectrum of bundle movement,
you subtract off the...
We don't subtract the background here. We just take, in effect, what we say is that the noise contributes to the signal.
Okay.
The noise contributes to the signal.
I mean to draw the comparison between the case when you're not forcing and you're in the spontaneously oscillatory regime, you'd have, in that sense, infinite sensitivity because the response would be non-zero because you have a peak in the spectrum at a frequency of oscillation and the forcing could be arbitrarily small.
Now I'm blanking. Did we subtract the noise? I forgot. You have a point here. But we have a saturation, so it cannot be. It doesn't diverge, right?
It doesn't diverge.
So.
So you don't have to force it to get a non-zero sensitivity when you're.
The question is, yeah. So we have this background noise, which comes from the oscillation, and then we have a peak here. And the question is, did we take this whole amplitude? Or did we subtract the noise? Can you take just that? I need to look back.
We take the whole amplitude.
Huh?
We
took the whole amplitude, right?
It's not zero. So when
we took the whole amplitude, I think.
Pascal, this is the fundamental reason that you see an optimum at the tail of the fish.
Yeah.
And we argue for best function near the head of the fish.
Yeah. For us, the signal is whatever you measure the frequency of the stimulus. And the frog doesn't know how to subtract this background thing. Okay, you can do it mathematically, but the frog will get whatever gets at this frequency. So the signal is what you get at this frequency.
Yeah, but it gets the noise in the absence, you know, in a quiet environment. It'll
no, it gets the noise, but of a very broad.
Right. But
so the noise is all that. This is the noise.
Yeah,
this is not just that. If the noise is just that, then you get no benefit from amplification whatsoever. In order to get a benefit, you need to define the noise at everything that is not at the frequency of stimulation.
I was just arguing, I think the frog is going to care about the delta of the peak as opposed to, it cares about the difference between the sound and its absence.
I don't know how I can measure it.
Single noise ratio, but usually you have to define a bandwidth for the detector.
Yeah.
It gives you a width that you take out of the noise.
So, in our case,
noise ratio.
So in our case, the bandwidth is much greater than the peak, the power spectrum you see from the oscillation. And that's what you need to get any amplification. If the bandwidth are very narrow, you will amplify the noise as much as the signal, you get no gain. In order to get any gain, you need to have a large bandwidth so that all the noise goes into your detector, mm-hmm. and then you benefit because you will detect this, you will see the increase in signal.
Yeah. I think I asked this before, but I don't remember the answer. In your experiment with cyberclones, did you try, so what you showed is identical frequencies. And I think that in the model, even if you couple oscillators with some sort of a tonotopic distribution of frequencies in the Dirac et al.
Yeah.
You're still sharpening, which is to me more interesting. You have oscillators at different frequencies coupled, and yet you see an improvement.
Yeah.
Did you try that with your cyber?
No, in the experiments we haven't tried. I mean, it was already hard enough that.
Yeah.
And then we switched to other product. We tried to match as the best we could
the
cell. But you're right in saying that.
It should still work, right? According
yeah,
to the model.
Yeah, it still works. Yeah, if you couple identical bundles together, that's where you get the max enhancement of sensitivity and sharpening of the tuning. If you take that as a reference, and now you start adding heterogeneity, so that you couple bundles that are not at the same frequencies, you will see a drop in sensitivity and a broadening of the tuning. And a remarkable feature that I see in Frank's simulations is that because we deal with a linear system, the effects are differential. So that is, in his simulations, you see that the decrease in sensitivity you have to pay for having this gradient in calcium frequencies is smaller than the decrease in tuning, which is interesting. Because it means that in this situation, you break the law that, you know, the gain times bandwidth is constant that you have for any resonator at a single resonator level. You break that law. You decrease the sensitivity not the same way as you increase the width of the peak, which is interesting.
Yeah. But when you showed this experiment with the gentamicin, I always thought that gentamicin binds and unbinds from the channel. So that means that the channel can still flicker. And you probably just block calcium entry.
Apparently, we block gating because we see no sign of getting compliance anymore.
Yeah,
everything is linear. The question is, what's the time scale of this binding on binding?
I don't know.
Me neither.
I was surprised.
In this experiment, it's
because
looks
then you would only change the activation time of the cluttering or the flickering of the channels.
But yeah, but if it gets slower, you would slow it down or something like that.
Yeah, but then you would have to measure slow. I mean, your
and
velocity.
As a matter of fact, I mean, if you looked, it may be what's happening at you right before we block. Because I showed you, there was a swindle in the slide that I showed you.
What was the concentration that's
happening? It's difficult. It's iontophoresis, so we have, you know, the usual high concentration in the pipette. We don't know what the concentration will be outside. You see here, it's very broad, okay? And this is not what we see on the control condition. Actually, what happens is it first broadens, probably because, as you say, we change the time scale of flickering, it slows down, and then it blocks, and this thing disappears. So it's a bit of what you say, but at the end, I mean, it's very linear. It's perfectly linear, so it seems that gating doesn't play a role anymore. If it gates, it doesn't play a role.
Cool. Thanks very much, Pascal.